Hi everyone, welcome to the Tech Entrepreneur on a Mission podcast. My name is Ton Dobbe and I'm the founder of Value Inspiration and the author of The Remarkable Effect. I envision a world where every B2B SaaS startup succeeds because they're creating software that customers would miss if they were gone. And here's why. Research consistently shows that 90% of all startups fail, and that's bad. What's worse, however, is that 75% of SaaS scale-ups fail, companies that are supposed to have product market fit. Far too few scale-ups create the traction they aspire for and fail for the wrong reasons. And I believe this should stop, and hence I created my business. And the goal that I have with this podcast is twofold. First, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential that we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. Secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what it requires to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. The guest on my podcast this week is Zach Wasserman, co-founder and chief evangelist of Fleet.
The best way to lose a deal is to our own product and to our own open source product, because those people remain prime prospective customers that we really need to continue to understand and figure out how we are going to show them, build enough new value in that premium product for them to want to pay for it.
This is Zach. With over a decade of experience in open source software development, Zach helped create the widely adopted OS Query project at Facebook in 2014. The project has now become the industry standard for device visibility and is now governed by the Linux Foundation. After transitioning through a role at Collide, which was later acquired by 1Password, Zach became the maintainer of the project that would eventually evolve into Fleet. Throughout his entrepreneurial journey, Zach discovered that what truly energizes him is building software that makes someone's life better, especially IT administrators and security professionals who manage company devices. This human-centered approach led him to transform a personal passion project into a rapidly growing company that's challenging traditional business models in enterprise software. And this inspired me, and hence I invited Zach to my podcast. We explore how being open source gives Fleet a strategic edge. His approach rejects the common belief that enterprise sales requires complexity and secrecy. We discuss how community building leads to faster adoption and better results than traditional sales tactics. The formula is simple: be transparent, earn trust, and close deals faster. By listening to this podcast, you will learn four things. Firstly, how building on existing open source foundations can give startups immediate credibility with enterprise customers. Secondly, why passionate early adopters can close deals remarkably easy compared to traditional prospects. Thirdly, the entrepreneurial wisdom of identifying and connecting with actual budget holders while still maintaining engineer enthusiasm. And lastly, how customer-driven, unexpected use cases can dramatically expand your market vision and product roadmap. Well, hi, Zach. Thank you for making the time available and being the guest on my podcast.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Pleasure. It's a long time ago since I had someone on the podcast that has actually started a business based on open source principles. So that's one of the reasons I wanted to have you on. I also am intrigued, of course, with the technology that you bring to market, Fleet device management, mobile device management, which of course is has become a big industry over the last 10 years. Before we start talking about your company and the big idea behind it, what drives you? What gives you energy as an entrepreneur?
As an entrepreneur, what really excites me is building software that's making someone's life better. So in my case, you know, it's the work life of an IT admin or a security person or a client platform engineer in a larger organization. So people who go to work every day and kind of live and breathe securing and managing their company's devices, making their life better so they can get their job done more effectively and have a smoother experience with that. And knowing that I'm helping make their day better is really kind of the most exciting and most gratifying part for me.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's already a good bridge to the business, of course. Why device management? What was the, you started your company in 21, I saw. What was the big idea behind it? What was the problem you tried to solve?
Yeah, so I could give you the medium version of the story or the long version, but I'll start with the medium and we can dig further back if you're interested.
Good.
So the story, in 2020 really starts with our initial investor, Sid C. Brandy, who was the CEO and founder of GitLab, had just had the experience of having to buy MDM software for the first time for the GitLab organization. And it was kind of something that they were doing in the lead up, couple years lead up to going public and making sure they were getting compliant with everything. And he just found the experience really underwhelming, the whole software, the sales process, everything to do with it, really underwhelming. And he thought we should have a good open source option for doing this. And meanwhile, I had been, and this is where the story could get long if we choose to go there, but I had been working for many years already at this point on a project called OS Query, which was something that I helped create at Facebook back in 2014, which helps essentially collect facts off of devices, Mac, Linux, Windows, devices. And so I was working on a project that at the time was called Collide Fleet because it was an offshoot of my former company, Collide. And it was a server for managing OS Query across all of your different devices. And so altogether, it gave you a really great way to understand the state of your devices, didn't yet have any functionality around actually managing that state. And so it was a popular choice for security and IT teams that needed to get better visibility. And our goal at Fleet kind of became like, let's round out that functionality while also introducing the functionality to actually actively manage the devices so that we can come in and replace these kind of legacy first generation solutions of MDM, if you will. I mean, you just mentioned that the space itself is only 10 years old. So we wanted to come in and kind of revolutionize it with an open source philosophy.
Nice. I get that. Funny, by the way, that you already start revolutionizing a sort of young market after 5 years.
Well, I do. It is really interesting because, like you said, MDM has only really been around 10 years. Like, and that's literally because I mean, I think it's now a little over 10 years now that Apple added the MDM protocols to first iOS and then macOS. And before that, there was just no such thing as MDM. And now it's like everyone needs MDM, and not just an organization that's going public, but like almost anyone, a 5-10 person organization who's getting their SOC 2 Type 2 for the first time, they need to get MDM in place. And we need to do it not just on our mobile devices, but on our Macs, our Windows, and some folks are even looking into like how do we manage our Linux workstations in this way where there isn't even yet an MDM protocol. So it's a space where there's a lot of rapid change because it's still so new and still being defined.
Yeah, exactly. So what is the big problem if you don't have it?
I mean, imagine, I think the easiest one to imagine is like your employee is sitting in a coffee shop working and they get up to grab their drink and someone snatches the laptop, right? If you don't have MDM, you have no control over that laptop. You don't know whether the screen lock was enabled on that so that when the lid gets closed, a password is required to log back in. You don't know whether the disk was encrypted with the data on it. And you definitely have no control once it's out of the employee's hands. But with MDM, you could ensure that from the first time that the user ever opened the computer, they have been required to set a password for logging in every time. The disk is encrypted, so the data is unreadable to someone who doesn't have a password. And you get the remote lock and remote wipe kind of capabilities that come with the MDM protocols as well, and that are built into the operating system that can really only be used in a corporate context through MDM. Of course, there's, for individuals, there's like the Find My Mac, Find My iPhone kind of stuff. But in a corporate context, those would typically not be used with personal iCloud accounts.
True, exactly. Yeah, I mean, that's you can imagine what can go wrong because not everybody is walking around with this PC that's just private use with a couple of games on it.
For
But
sure, for sure. And there's
exactly.
so many more reasons as well, ranging from the technical to, like I said, the SOC 2 Type 2. It doesn't specifically say you need MDM, but it says you need to be able to manage the workstations that employees are working on. And effectively, that means MDM, and that's what the auditors are looking out for when they do those
Exactly.
reviews.
Exactly. So you started this business, well, in early 2020. Then you started, you created a solution, first of all, based on the idea of your previous company, which is the always query part, and then adding functionality to it to actually manage the state. What did you do differently to stand out in that market, to not have that underwhelming experience that one of your investors came about?
Yeah, of course. So there's a few things that we do to set us apart from the kind of existing players in the space. So one is just being built on this sort of open core philosophy through and through. And so this extends from things like, of course, you can go and read our source code, you can modify it, you can put in pull requests. You can see the plans for what we're building. You can see the designs. You can see the code reviews that are happening. For the most part, people have jobs to get done. They're not looking, but our customers do look. They do get to see, they do get to test, and they do get to contribute to those things. And not just our customers, but our community open source users get to participate in that way. But that's not the only way that this kind of open source philosophy is baked in. It's also baked in things like we've been the first MDM to allow you to kind of bring some DevOps concepts such as configuration as code into the IT and security space. So now people can use the collaboration tools that they're used to, like their GitHub, their GitLab, to do things like change the configurations of all of these things that we can manage on the devices, and those can be peer reviewed by other folks within their organization and then pushed out automatically by their continuous integration tooling. So that's kind of a big new step in a technical direction that's very inspired by sort of the open source underpinnings that we have. The other big thing that we're working on that really sets us apart is okay, so there's two more actually, but the second one that I point out is being really great support cross-platform. So cross-platform MDMs do exist. For example, Microsoft Intune supports pretty much every platform you'd want MDM on, except Linux. It doesn't support Linux at all. But for example, the leading player in the Mac space, Jamf, which many people do love, does only Apple products. And so it means if you have Windows, which more organization doesn't, then you got to get something else to manage
Yeah, true.
Windows. And then if you have Linux, you have to get probably yet another. So what we've done is we've kind of started with Apple products as first class, as our top priority, so that we can kind of get to parity with Jamf first and allow people to replace that. But we're also building out really great support for Windows and for Linux, which is almost unprecedented in the MDM space. And that's something that becomes really exciting for our customers who are getting not only a better experience on their Macs, but they're getting for the first time ever, perhaps, management onto their Windows and Linux workstations. And then, of course, we do servers and stuff as well, which is not typically done by other MDM solutions. So that's two. And then number three is, like I said, our foundation was on understanding the state of the devices. And most of these MDM solutions started by focusing on changing the state and not being really good at just understanding the state. And so people kind of struggle to see, from your Jamf or your Microsoft, you're getting updates like once a day on what's going on devices. We can get you updates in seconds or minutes on what's going on the devices. And I believe that it's really important to know what your current state is if you're trying to move towards a new, more secure, or more productive state for those devices.
Exactly. Yeah. Fascinating. I mean, I hear a number of things, and I think if you add them up, they create sort of a, I mean, to me, it almost becomes like, why would you choose anything else? You know, it has the breadth, it has the depth, it addresses a number of issues that others have never maybe want to address, too hard to do, maybe.
Yeah, and that's certainly what we hope our prospects see, and certainly the value that our customers are getting out of the product.
Yeah. Is it also the reason why you chose the open source route and not the maybe the commercial route, as many software companies do?
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple of reasons for that. The main reasons would be one, like I said, the foundation of this is open source software that I've been working on going back to 2014. So first, it's the agent that sits on each individual computer, OS query, which is something that I helped create at Facebook in 2014. We open sourced it that year, and it has grown and grown and become used, kind of become industry standard really for getting visibility off devices. And I think it was 2018 or 19, the OS query project was transitioned to the Linux Foundation. So it's now independently run, and we have a technical steering committee, which I sit on with folks from a handful of other organizations, and we have hundreds of contributors coming to that. So that's like really where it all emerged from. The next project that I worked on was actually a closed source commercial product that we were building on top of OS Query at my former company called Collide, which has since been acquired by 1Password. But at Collide, when we pivoted away from that project, we actually open sourced it and kind of abandoned it. And then people started using it. And when Collide then pivoted again, one of my co-founders and I left the company, I was drawn back to, again, my roots and interest in open source. And so I became the kind of sole maintainer of that project, Collide Fleet, which a number of really awesome organizations were now using at this point. And so that kind of leads to Sid C. Brandy, again, the CEO and founder of GitLab, who had built up this huge company that was getting close to going public at billions of dollars. He had built it up on the open core model, and he was looking for technical entrepreneurs, or really just technical maintainers of open source projects who wanted to become entrepreneurs and build open core companies on top of their products. So he reached out to me and said, "What do you think? Like, can we build this into something commercial in the space?" So he set me up with our CEO, Mike McNeil, my co-founder, and the initial funding, and acted as sort of a co-founder for us, and continues to be an important advisor to us on the journey.
Yeah, can I completely understand that? Like-minded people, like-minded beliefs. What fascinates me here is that you said a couple of times, okay, we open sourced it, and then we created a product on top of that. We closed sourced it, and then we open sourced it. And so you're going back and forth between the different models. What are reasons to do that?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I mean, I would say it's clear what some of the challenges to building a commercial open source company are clear. And the biggest challenge, I think, in that is that your own open source product may become your biggest competitor. So people say, "Why would I pay you for the premium version of this when I can get the free version and use it without paying you?"
Yeah, true.
And that's not good for, losing deals in a B2B company like is a big deal. You got to be closing deals to grow your revenue and customer base and to continue supporting and building the product. So that's a big deal. Our philosophy, though, generally is the best way to lose a deal is to our own product and to our own open source product, because those people remain prime prospective customers that we really need to continue to understand and figure out how we are going to show them, build enough new value in that premium product for them to want to pay for it.
Is that the same issue as companies have that have a premium model and a paid version?
For sure. Yeah, I think it's very similar to that. The other thing that I think is really important about open source in this space is that our software is sitting on the computing devices that are owned by people's employers, right? Usually, although not always, when you consider like a BYOD, my Android device that hooks up to my company email and calendar, and sometimes then has to be managed by the company. But regardless, people use their workstations to chat with their partners and send messages to their kids and share family photos and that kind of thing. And I think people rightfully care about what software is running on those computers. And so, of course, your average end user can't go and read our code and understand it, but the power users can and do read the underlying agent code, they can read the server code, and we can build on that philosophy of transparency to be leading towards what we think is a better vision for this software that's running on people's devices. I don't think we should ever have to leave people speculating as to what the company might be looking for or managing on a device. We should let them know and see, because I think that this is kind of basic dignity.
Gotcha. Another question on the open source. Well, the community, you said we have hundreds of contributors. Is this the way to create that momentum that you're looking for when you're entering that space that's already existing, and you are, dedicated to set the new bar? Is that open source the way to go in order to create that momentum with people that you don't employ but want to believe in the same thing?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we definitely benefit from riding on the coattails, if you will, of the OS Query project. At the time, in the early days, having the sort of legacy and power of Facebook behind it meant a lot. I think now people's perceptions of Facebook have changed, certainly. But these days, now having the legacy of the Linux Foundation behind the project brings a lot of credibility, and something that it really brings is it allows a startup that we're now not tiny, but when we were tiny, let's say in 2020, just a couple of co-founders, it allowed us to bring so much credibility in, because we were built on a foundation of software that was deployed across millions of computers and some of the leading organizations. It was well known that it was deployed that way. And I think that understandably, people expect that there's a bit of reciprocity when you get that benefit of working on such a foundation. And so certainly there have been other companies to come in and use OS Query because it's open source. You do whatever you want with it, like MIT license. This is cool. It's great. I'm glad that anyone can do whatever they want with it. But I think that understandably, folks in the community want to see organizations that are more giving back by contributing directly to that project or contributing their source code and just the spirit of openness and reciprocity to their endeavors. That does, I think, help build momentum, especially when you're trying to build that early credibility.
Can open source only succeed when it's embedded in a technology community? Because at the end, it's about development, right? Or have you seen models succeed as well that are, in principle, not really targeted at a tech audience?
I'm not personally familiar with that, but I do think that open source needs either individuals who are passionate about it to succeed, or, and ideally both, but or it needs organizations that care enough about it to fund the development and maintenance.
Yeah,
because these
true.
things don't get themselves done, and open source contributors mostly don't get to feed their families with their open source contributions.
No, that's
Now,
true.
I have managed to build my career doing that. Now, for 10 years, I've worked on open source and sort of built my primary income off of open source software now. And there are other people in this community who do. So it is very much possible, but it's a complex sort of dance, and I think it's something that it really does require a passionate contributors who are willing to kind of who have the skills and the willingness to step out and do something that's a little bit non-traditional in terms of the career and making money.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, exactly. I want to talk a little bit about like the moment you learned, well, the product is ready, then you start working and you want to get, you're talking about deals and winning deals in the B2B space. What was that journey towards your first 100 customers? What was the biggest lesson you learned there?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, we learned so many things, but the thing that's coming to mind for me is looking at the first few customers who you might say were like the true believers. They had been, they had been following my journey and the journey of things, our foundations like OS Query for years. They maybe were already using them, or they had already tinkered with them, or those people had used them in their prior jobs. Closing those deals was remarkably easy compared to closing the deals later with people who were not primed and ready and already believers for that. So we were able to land some very large deals out of, kind of the passion and enthusiasm and belief of the community. And then we really kind of went on the journey to product market fit, right? And that's when we had to start really understanding what it was that we were going to be able to turn into a repeatable sale, and how we could, not only build the product for a repeatable sale, but also go to market for a repeatable sale. And once we'd tapped the pretty limited set of people who are really familiar with the very niche technologies that we worked in, how do we start to frame all of this to people who've never heard of the technology, but they have the problems? Of course, everyone has the problems.
So what was the big thing that worked there? I mean, I'm in the middle of this always, and it predictability, repeatability is such a big thing that everybody strives for, and it's so hard to do. Because with repeatability comes predictability, and once you get to that point, and of course there's product market fit that everybody's talking about, but even with product market fit, I see companies that have beautiful product market fit still not repeatable, and by far not predictable.
For sure.
So.
For sure. So of course it's always an ongoing journey, but I think that for that you really start to look over to the business side. So how do we start prospecting for and qualifying leads that we think are really primed for adopting our product? And so for us, it kind of became a sweet spot of a certain company size. The companies that are primarily using Macs, but also not just using Macs, have a non-trivial number of Windows or Linux computers. We start to look at it, especially for, one of the really big challenges, I think, especially with an open source product, is you can get into a lot of conversations with passionate engineers who have no budget, no buying power. So, and this is where our guidance from Sid, especially, and his experience with GitLab really came in so handy. And this wasn't, my focus area, but I watched as Mike, our CEO, my co-founder, learned how to work with engineers to understand their organizations and who the buyer was with the actual purchasing power, and how we could craft a good pitch to them. And now we know, in a lot of ways, we know what steps we need when we come in touch with an organization before we can start to expect that we'll reasonably be able to close a deal. And so we know how to walk our engineers through the journey of connecting with the buyer and their organization and pitching and making sure that we're getting the value to the buyer. And conversely, we know how to work with buyers when they're more of the kind of executive side to go to their engineers and work on implementing something that's actually going to leave everyone happy as well, because deals die when there's resistance from either direction.
Exactly. Resistance, no sense of urgency, not understanding the value it brings, and these type of things. You mentioned the word passion a number of times. How important is that in the whole realm? I mean, I wrote my book, The Remarkable Effect, and at the end, that's what I also believe. What I believe is that, something needs to be both valuable but also desirable, and I think it's in the desirable bit where the passion hides.
I mean, I think that it's not the easy path to do something different, right? And whether that's you're an entrepreneur doing something different by creating a new company and trying to convince people to switch to it and even trying to define a new category in a way, or whether you are a person in an organization looking to buy a software to manage the organization's computers, and you're looking at going out on a limb to say, let's try this startup's software because we think it's going to be worth it. But you're I you know, on either side of that, these are people who are a little bit forging their own path and are taking on risk there, and have to be passionate to do that, because the easy thing to do would be to just keep doing the same thing and collecting the paycheck, right? Regardless of whether it's stepping out to found something or whether it's looking at something new to bring into an organization. But some people are just excited to do that and are not excited to just pick up the paycheck and would rather do something interesting and shoot for growth.
But that's all about psychographics at the end. And even if you look, I mean, I see the examples also in the commercial world. Two organizations looking equal on the outside are radically different from the inside because of what's happening with what people want and what people aspire for.
And there's an aspect of passion on the kind of the other end as well. Not only when you talk about the buyer, but when you talk about when you think about the people who are running customer success and customer service in our organization, they're actually passionate about our product. Like, they've learned a lot. We've got people in our organization who we've sort of taken a chance on because we believe that they had some very basic technical skills, but really great personal skills and great potential. And those people have now advanced so much in their careers and their impacts. And that brings to them, I think, a lot of passion for our product and our company. And I think that that kind of thing wears, shows to our customers and our prospective customers who end up just getting a better experience, because everyone, I think, loves to work with passionate people.
True. Exactly. Brings me to the question, what can commercial software companies learn from, the momentum that open source companies create because of attracting believers?
I mean, I think that everyone can go back to just like remembering, it's almost like negotiations 101, but like both parties should leave a negotiation satisfied, right? And if you want to really take this to the extreme, you could look at like say everything, every interaction is a negotiation in some way. I'm speaking with you because I want something. You're speaking with me because you want something. We don't have to look at that in an adversarial perspective. We look at it as in collaboration, we'll build something together. And so I think that adds up to understanding that money exchanged and the money that the software that you're selling generates on the other end, like, is just a part of it. There's also humans in the middle who care about things beyond money. But money is our bottom line too. Like, this is business, right? So we need to find ways to build reciprocity and to treat other people in ways that they're going to feel good about that goes beyond the dollar values. And I think that that's something that open source historically has been really great at. It's like money is not there at all. The more modern iterations of open source, where we're starting to see so many more commercial open source companies, we're bringing money in, but we're trying to keep the reciprocity and the community aspects there. And so I think that any commercial organization can remember that, like, people like balance and people appreciate community and reciprocity.
Yeah, exactly. There's also, well, you good that you mentioned community, because it's a big thing in the open source world, open source community, for good reasons, because that's how the model works and everybody contributes to the same thing. But what always is sort of astonished me is that so many commercial companies don't even think about building community, whereby they could. If I come from the ERP world, we had a commercial product. Once a year, we do a user conference, and then these people come together and they have a name badge. And yeah, well, maybe there's 50 people you want to talk to, but it's hard to find them in the first place because it's just a once per year event. Whereby, if you bring procurement managers together and controllers and CFOs that can contribute to, well, how do you use the product in the best way? And even leveling up in the domain itself, such a wealth of value you can create by bringing these people together, even if it's not even contributing to your product. But that is, I think, also a sidestep of it.
Yeah, for sure. And it's something that we see in our space as well. And you can see a big contrast in our competitors. So take our two biggest competitors, Jamf, who is the big one in the Apple space, and then Microsoft, with their Intune product, who does cross-platform everything, even though it's Microsoft, they do Apple, and all that. If you look at Jamf, and both these are commercial, closed source. If you look at Jamf, they have their Jamf Nation, they call it, which is like an online community. They have a user conference, they sponsor meetups, and they have a lot of really dedicated Jamf admins, people who've kind of built their career on that and who are real believers in that. So you don't have to be open source at all to build community in that way. And I commend them certainly on doing that. If you contrast that with Microsoft, like, everyone knows what the Microsoft experience is like, or everyone who's tried to deal with Microsoft knows what that experience is like. Good luck finding a human anywhere through the process. I've done it recently working with Azure cloud products, and it's not a very human experience. It's not a very community oriented experience. So the range is definitely possible regardless of whether you've come from the open source, but it's just really in the DNA of open source, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, talking about the community, one of the things you said is that, well, you got contributors. They also give you feedback. What has been maybe the most unexpected way that the customer has used your product, provided feedback that actually changed sort of the course of where you were going, maybe the fork?
Ooh, interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think that one of oh, something that was that's really kind of interesting and unexpected for me from a technical perspective is we had a customer who approached us and said, we're an electric vehicles automaker and we have all these computers in our factory. Like, it's a modern company. They've got computers everywhere in the factory. And our vendor that we were using to get visibility into those computers pushed out an update that actually caused us downtime in the factory. And we need to do something different here. And this was like, we hadn't seen this before. We hadn't been in factories. before that, but we looked at our product, we looked at the computers that they were using in the factories, and we were able to say, it seems like it should work. Like, let's go and try it.
Let me make a small interruption here. Zach just made an excellent remark that sets his approach apart from traditional enterprise software vendors. The realization is not about limiting your focus on predefined markets, but embracing unexpected customer use cases that expand your vision. That change not only leads to immediate new business opportunities, but also creates a broader strategic identity that enables continuous growth into adjacent markets. It's a trait remarkable software companies master. Number one, their curiosity leads them. For example, by actively seeking feedback on how customers use their products in unexpected ways. Number two, they aim to be different, not just better. For example, by letting passionate customers expand their vision. Number three, they master the art of creating momentum. For example, by using customer-driven use cases to systematically expand into adjacent markets that competitors might miss. And you can master these traits as well. The first step? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy, and inspiration will spark within 10 minutes. Back to the interview.
And we get to do really cool things. Like we, you know, our solutions engineers get to go in and help folks install onto like a controller for a factory robot. And we see like, okay, these things do work. And so now we've like opened up this whole new domain of a different type of computing device that we didn't know much about at all. And since we've started to learn much more about, and for me, you know, this is super exciting and interesting because if you look back at our company name, I'm not sure how intentional we were at this, but it's Fleet Device Management. And from that name, I've sort of adopted the philosophy that anything that's a computing device, we should be able to manage eventually, right? So whether it's a factory robot, it's a phone, it's a IoT device, which we don't do yet, but whether it's a Mac, Windows, Linux server, Windows server, Chromebooks, we now do, like anything that's a computing device, we should be able to do. And so having a customer come in with a novel use case and then being able to work with them to figure out and see that it works and go ahead with that, and then have that begin to influence all our future decisions as we think about, you know, what do we need to support? That's to me like the exciting story there.
Yeah, I can completely agree with that. Sometimes it's you need those type of interactions to get your breakthrough. And I mean, you're right. The fleet is the fleet, and once you get known for that, because that also then is all encompassing for customers. It's not only Mac, it's not only Windows, it's the fleet, and that is a huge differentiator. Exactly. Two more questions because I also need to look at the time here. Yeah, I mean, since you started the business with the other co-founders, how has your su definition of success changed since? Or has it changed? And if so, how?
Interesting question. Yeah, I mean, I think that the really big shift was for me was going from, as I said, sole sort of maintainer and developer of this open source project to founder of a commercial company. That there was the really massive shift for me. But looking at the shift, any shifts since then, I would say that we started the company with the idea to really follow in the footsteps of GitLab. You know, the buyer-based open core model that Sid pioneered and that he used to take GitLab from startup to public. That's the path that we set out to follow, and that's the path that we continue to follow. So I think that in that, you know, the journey is still pretty early on, but the intent is to just keep growing our community, serving our customers, and eventually to IPO and be, you know, another example that open core and open source can really be viable commercial models.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's sort of almost the drive from within to prove everybody wrong. The first thing I always, I mean, the idea is always with open source is, yeah, it's for, you give it away for free, and you might earn some money with software, but the rest is, but it's not a, that's not the case anymore.
Yeah, and I mean for these people who were doing this 10 years ago, like they had so few examples to look at. You had Red Hat was like the big open source company. But now we have better examples. We have GitLab, we have Elastic. So we have a wide range of examples to look at of organizations that are doing this and have done it successfully, are public and continue to be successful.
Yeah, exactly. So what is the future of open source from a commercial model perspective?
I think the future from the commercial model is this buyer-based open core model, which for those who aren't familiar, search buyer-based open core. It's a talk by Sid C. Brandy. Maybe we can drop a link in the show notes or something, but it is this philosophy that we need to continue to build open source software that continues to focus on delivering value, regardless of whether someone's paying money or not. It continues to give people the freedom to use it and modify it as they like, and that can actually be adopted and implemented into an enterprise, regardless of whether they're paying money. But we look at what do the buyers, the people who are in control of the budget and the buying decisions in an organization, what do they want to see? What do they need to see, and what will bring them value? So that once we're in the organization, because individual contributors have done it and brought value, we can go to the buyer. The buyer can find out for themselves that there's more that they can unlock that will bring specifically their goals into fruition. And that's where we sort of draw the lines between what goes into the open source part of the product and what goes into the open core, so source available, but you need to pay for a premium license part of the product. And that's what enables us to continue to kind of build the balance that allows us to support the community and reciprocity while also making a commercially viable organization.
Makes total sense. Makes total sense. Exactly. It's the freemium model with the premium option that is that's been popularized in the commercial world, without, of course, the benefit of having a community contributing. And I like that distinction there. Okay, last question then. If you'd think about your entrepreneurial career, entrepreneurial journey so far, what would be a do, and what would be a don't that you'd like to share as advice to other tech entrepreneurs that aspire, taking a similar growth path?
I mean, do follow your own passions for sure, because this is definitely not the easy path. So if you're not excited about what you're doing, then don't do it, right? Like, do it once you find that excitement, because it's going to be harder, but it can be that much more gratifying for being able to draw your own path. And I would say, don't overly focus on external value validation, because it's easy come, easy go for sure. If your self-worth comes from the valuation of your company, the headlines that you make in the news, these kind of things, you'll have some really good days and you'll
And
have a
some
lot
very
of
bad
really
ones.
bad days.
Exactly. I like that, I also always applaud for those entrepreneurs that measure their success by the impact they help their customers create. And if you do that well, and it's also the whole premise of my book, The Remarkable Effect, then the value will come your way in ways that you cannot anticipate or forecast for. Thank you very much, Zach, for sharing the wisdom that you build on the journey. Good luck on the next 5 years. Might do a podcast in that time again.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me, Don.
Was a pleasure. And this ends my conversation with Zach, and I hope you enjoyed it. If so, please leave a review on iTunes. And if it inspired you, please share it with other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that you have in your network. Other than that, thank you for tuning into this podcast. I had the honor to speak to Zach Wasserman, co-founder of Fleet. As said, The goal that I have in this podcast is twofold. Firstly, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. And secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what is required to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. Before I close, I have two more comments to make. If you know other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that have a story worth sharing, please send me an email at ton.dobby@valueinspiration.com. Building the momentum all starts with revealing the ideas, and that starts with you. And if you want to know more about my book, or you're interested in joining the Remarkable Effect tribe, please visit my website at www.valueinspiration.com. Thanks for tuning in. And you could do me a big favor by rating the podcast on iTunes or provide me with your feedback directly. I'll see you shortly on a new episode.